I am unwilling to give up, that I will start over from scratch as many times as it takes to get where I want to be.
You just want to make sure you will get knocked down, but just make sure you don't get knocked out.
So your only choice should be go focus on what you can control.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Kara Golden Show. Join me each week for inspiring conversations with some of the world's greatest leaders. We'll talk with founders, entrepreneurs, CEOs, and really some of the most interesting people of our time. Can't wait to get started. Let's go. Hi, everyone. It's Kara Golden from The Kara Golden Show, and I am so, so thrilled to have my next guest here. It is truly an honor. We have Mitch Kapor, who is the entrepreneur and co-author, amongst other things, of Closing the Equity Gap. And I am so, so thrilled to have him here, not only to chat about his brand new book, which is awesome, that he co-authored with his wife, Frida, but also just to talk overall about being an entrepreneur and his journey. Mitch, by the way, for those who are not familiar with him, is a pioneer in the personal computing industry, most notably founding Lotus Development Corporation and designing the iconic Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet. But he's also the founding partner of Kapor Capital, which focuses on investing in early stage startups that address urgent social needs and transform industries. And I'm super, super excited to hear not only about his journey, but also about investing and, of course, the incredible book, Closing the Equity Gap. So welcome, Mitch.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. So before we get into your terrific book, I would love to start where I think of when I hear your name over the many years that I've also been in Silicon Valley, but Lotus. So how did you come up with this idea?
Well, this was at the dawn of the personal computer era. I mean, really early days. So even before businesses were adopting personal computers. But it was clear to me, a few people, that these productivity tools, spreadsheets, word processors, and the like, were going to be very empowering and really be a game changer by putting computing power in the hands of non-technical individuals. That had never happened. And so a huge event back then was when IBM introduced a personal computer. Mm-hmm. Before that, people were using Apple II, Commodore PET, Radio Shack, kind of more hobbyist than not. But IBM had a big brand and also a much more powerful machine. So we made a bet that by customizing a spreadsheet, because we weren't the first spreadsheet, but taking full advantage of the greater memory and the faster processor speed and the brand of IBM, that we could really do something that would resonate in the marketplace. And we made it as easy to use as possible and as powerful as we could. I had a great co-founder, technical genius. I was the designer and the product manager, and we were in the right place at the right time. And so I'll tell you, I wrote the business plan. We said $3 million in sales. This was 1983. We actually did $53 million in our first year and then tripled. So the world really was waiting for a reason, the business world, to buy a desktop computer, and Lotus 1-2-3 was it. And we became the dominant software company of that era.
That's crazy. Well, I remember that so well. And it's I think you answered my next question. Did you ever imagine that it would be as big as it became?
Yeah. No, we knew we had done a great product, but I didn't have any idea of how large the market was going to be, or that we would rise to the top. And so I called it what happened with Lotus after we shipped was sort of a success disaster. We had this explosive growth in the company. We went from no employees to a couple of thousand employees. Really, we were that template that later, you know, Google and Facebook and others have gone through. We were sort of the zeroth iteration of that, and just trying to stay on top of it all was a interesting, huge and often terrifying challenge as an entrepreneur.
When you think back, when you've obviously mentored many entrepreneurs, what was the most difficult part of building and scaling what you did?
It is that the skills that it takes to go from zero to one, to start, to bring a product to market, to lead a small team, are completely different than the skills you need to take something from, say, 20 or 30 people to 100 or 1,000 people. How you manage it, how you communicate, what role you play as the founder, it all changes and changes again and changes again. And so when you're riding that kind of rocket ship, you either have to be really good at adaptation, or it's not the right role to play, and so you're constantly overcoming your own self-doubt, deciding what you really want to do. I mean, I was a serial entrepreneur, only that term was not in the vocabulary, so I didn't have role models of, okay, I can start this and hand it over and then go start something else. So yeah, managing the growth and not being overwhelmed by it, biggest challenge.
So I went out to the Twitter audience yesterday, and I told people that I was interviewing you, and there were a few questions that people asked. One of them that I thought was interesting: if you could go back in time to the year before Excel was released by Microsoft, maybe 1 year prior, would you do anything differently?
Before Excel was released? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think there is. Sometimes... Well, as a designer, what I would have done is kept it simple and taken the same Lotus 1-2-3 and moved it over to the Macintosh, which is where Excel came out, and then moved it to Windows. Not try to reinvent, go to the next level, do something even fancier, but really stick to the bread and butter basics, but spread it across every computing platform that looked like it had potential. Lotus didn't do that. And I left in the middle of this to do other things. So some of this was on my watch. Most of it was not. But Excel, by being, you know, the first graphical user interface spreadsheet, first for the Mac and then ultimately for Windows, really, they were riding the right platform choice. And Lotus, after I was gone, didn't make that choice. And it was fatal.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
So you designed it and you stayed on as CEO until you ultimately replaced yourself.
Yeah.
How did you make that decision? I know it's frequently, they're CEOs. Maybe some of them are founders, some of them aren't. How do you make that decision?
How did I make that decision? I think in a word, poorly. I had painted myself into a corner. I wish myself of today could have been around to give me advice then on what to do about building a different kind of C-suite and a different kind of board. But I just felt trapped. And there was a guy who was very aggressive in the senior management and was really trying to take it all on. And at a certain point, I just said, I'm leaving. It's yours. And it was it was a bad exit. And I sort of learned a huge amount from it about succession planning. But by the time, back then it was all happening so fast. And there was not, this was 1985, 86. Mm-hmm. Today, there are hundreds of more senior people, mentors, advisors. You can, if you're a fledgling entrepreneur, you can get help. Back then, I felt much more sort of isolated. And so I learned a lot about how when you hire, when you promote, when you choose people to have, that trust is very important. Alignment around values is really important. And I would have made a really different set of choices, really different. But water under the bridge of...
Well, and you obviously have done really, really well. You went on after Lotus to co-found the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the founding chair of Mozilla Foundation, which is the creator of the Firefox web browser. You also serve on the board of an incredible company that I'm familiar with, Smash, the Summer Math and Science Honors Academy, which is really, really awesome. And obviously, you're doing a ton of investing through Kapoor Capital in early stage startups that address the urgent social needs. And now you've written co-written a terrific book with your co-author and wife, Frida, called Closing the Equity Gap. Why did you decide to write this book?
Well, the book is really the story of the last dozen years of work, this professional chapter that was unexpected, but for which I'm very grateful, about investing with a really different lens on impact and on diversity. I mean, because Kapoor Capital started out as an experiment a dozen years ago. And when Frida started nudging me, I was doing a lot of angel investing at that point. She said, this is great. Some of these things are big hits, but what about investing in a way that is more aligned with your own personal values? Mm-hmm. And I was very skeptical. I said, I'll miss out on all the hot deals. I just have to go for whatever I think is going to be big. But Frida can be very persuasive. And I thought she might be right. So we started an experiment. And the book is the story of what happened with that experiment. And that experiment was, what if we invest only in companies that specifically are gap closing? And what I mean by that is that their core purpose, their mission, what they do is to close gaps of access or of opportunity or of outcome for low-income communities or communities of color. Can we do that in a way that has impact, that is measurable, but also produces top-tier financial returns? And we didn't know when we started this. And the book is case studies of companies we've invested in, the fantastic founders, their lived experience, what they've created, the problems that they're solving, and what our outcomes have been. And, you know, spoiler alert, over a decade and 150 companies, we produced top quartile financial results. In other words, in the top 25% of all venture funds of our size, regardless of how they invest. And the reason that's so striking is it defies all conventional wisdom, which says in the investing world, in the venture capital world, if you pay attention to impact, anything but financial returns, you're actually going to sacrifice or compromise those returns. Our data and our stories and our portfolio says otherwise. And the book lays all of that out to share with the world. And what we learned along the way and the mistakes that we made in our investing best practices and also you just meet some fabulous entrepreneurs in the book.
Your business is growing and customers love what you're doing, but to keep them coming back, you need to keep adding value and engaging them at every level. That's where Thinkific Plus can help. Thinkific Plus is easy to use, tough to beat. So what is it? Thinkific Plus is a powerful learning platform that you can use to engage your customers, a platform that provides businesses with a powerful way to keep customers, vendors, partners, or employees educated, informed, and trained. Plus, did I mention how easy it is to use? And with Thinkific Plus, you get more than just robust features. You also get a dedicated customer success team that is seriously dedicated to helping you reach your goals of engaging with who matters most. So many businesses rely on Thinkific Plus to make their goals happen. Businesses like Hootsuite, for example, one of the world's most widely used social media management platforms. They use Thinkific Plus to host their online training site, Hootsuite Academy, offering everything from online courses for social media marketing as well as platform training. By using Thinkific Plus, they've been able to train and certify nearly 500,000 consumers in social media marketing. It's really all pretty awesome. Start educating your customers at scale. Thinkific Plus is a great option for anyone who wants that straightforward choice. Sign up now for one incredible offer. Our listeners get one free month of Thinkific Plus when you use the special code. Go to thinkific.com/Kara. That's K-A-R-A to start educating your customers at scale. Get your free month with promo code Kara, K-A-R-A. That's thinkific.com/Kara. That's think, thinkific.com/Kara. thinkific.com/Kara. Why don't you think more VCs are doing this? I mean, I think it takes patience for sure. I'm curious, you know, what's your feeling? Do you think patience is not something that most VCs understand or are willing to kind of sit with?
I think it may be less a matter of patience and more that people simply accept the conventional wisdom, because this is what they learn and what's taught in business school. And they have, there's some ignorance also. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for instance, when you invest in a founder, how important is their pedigree? Do you need to have a BS in computer science from Stanford? Do you need to have gone to Harvard? We have a very contrarian view that that stuff is almost utterly irrelevant. We're very interested in distance traveled. It's like, meaning, if you look at someone and you say, how far have they come in life already? What hurdles and barriers have they overcome based on their own, you know, own efforts? Mm-hmm. And to the extent that they, you know, have succeeded in that, it tells you a lot about persistence and resilience and characteristics of successful entrepreneurs. And so, we make a different set of choices about talent to back. And I think if you don't have that lens, though, and you have a conventional lens, you're going to miss out on all this. You're just not going to see these opportunities or you're going to write them off. And so part of what it takes is some shift in mindset about how we think about what success is likely to look like in doing startup. And honestly, there's a bit of more than a bit of herd mentality in Silicon Valley. I mean, you really have to step up and challenge it. And where we've had, I would say, the most impact in altering people's thinking is this. We have companies that have these amazing founders with big distance traveled stories that don't look like the founders are used to. We do the seed stage, and they do well. Then they go and raise an A from mainstream VCs who look and say, this is a great business. Mm-hmm. And they make a decision they otherwise wouldn't have made. That gets them rethinking. Well, what about more folks like this? And how do you do this? And because they see they want to win these deals and they're not the usual deals. So really believe, rather than trying to make abstract arguments about why diversity is good or why impact is good, you want real world examples of companies that are doing things differently, are having that positive impact, whether it could be in healthcare, it could be in fintech, it could be in job creation. It's not about the sector. It's about whether the company is closing a gap. That's hence the title of the book.
Definitely. So let's talk about the founder's commitment. Can you explain about the founder's commitment?
Sure. So this actually was 2016. I think we're the first, to our knowledge, venture firm to make it a requirement that when we won't write a check without a company committing to building a diverse workforce and an inclusive culture. This is the founder's commitment. And it's not a matter of quotas. It is not a matter of us dictating what to do. We provide resources on our platform team to actually help companies with recruiting and building a diverse workforce and helping with inclusivity in the culture. But we are looking for that a commitment. we use it as a criterion to invest, but also to reinvest. So we look at down the road, because, you know, in the next round and the next round after that, obviously you look at the traction the company is getting and their progress against goals. But these companies all have goals around diversity and inclusion. And we have a conversation. If they've disregarded them, mm-hmm. if they haven't just paid lip service and haven't paid any attention to it at all, like, then that's a negative signal for us about, you know, reinvesting. So, and other number of other venture firms have either adopted the founder's commitment or something analogous to it, saying it's important and it's just part of the fabric of how we work as investors.
So you have more pipeline than you could possibly invest in. How do you select among too many deserving projects vying for your attention?
Well, so this is really an issue, I think, for all venture firms, the amount of inbound interest and inquiries. I mean, typically, you know, we might do 15, 20 new investments a year or something like that, and we get thousands of inquiries, as do others. Mm-hmm. But we do some very specific things. So first, we're very clear about what our investment criteria are. They're up on the website, and we practice, you know, what we preach, so that people can self-select. Mm-hmm. They can know whether, is this a gap-closing company, or not. That's one thing. Two, we don't require a warm intro. We, in fact, think warm intros, where you have to know someone who knows someone in the firm, actually winds up restricting the pool of, so we have a process and a set of questions, a little short form on the website. I think we may have been the first or among the first to do this, that we ask everybody to go through. It ensures a fair process. And I can tell you that there's no secret sauce. The investment team takes very seriously going through each and every one of those and responding. But because our criteria are clear, and we ask people to do a little bit of work in submitting the form, it just becomes part of the routine to process these 3,000. And we have, on more than one occasion, written a check to a founder and a team. We didn't really know people that they knew. It came in, you know, through the website, but it fit. It was a great business and, mm-hmm. and doing really well. So, you know, it takes a commitment.
Yeah.
And I think, us or anybody else, you really have to be prepared to walk the walk, not just talk the talk. And that's the issue for the whole industry.
Well, I was reading an article, I think, that you wrote or somebody wrote it about your process, but funding a company is often tough for first-time founders, not to mention women and multicultural founders. What do you see are some of the mistakes that some founders are making? I'll give you a hint that the article that I thought was fascinating was that while people might pitch you on kind of what they're doing, they're not so open to sharing their backstory of kind of where they came from.
Right.
And I thought that was fascinating.
Well, a mission-oriented founder will get advice from conventional investors not to mention that or to mention diversity in their deck. They'll say, take it out, because people don't want to hear that and they're not going to invest. That's just the conventional wisdom. But when people do that, how can we find each other if they hide who they are?
Yeah.
And so, we think people should be clear about what their fundamental commitments are. But, you know, more than that, I could think of several key things when people are just starting out that's important to get right or have consequences if you get wrong. I mean, one is to understand if you really have a venture scale business. Mm-hmm. There are many important gap closing kinds of activities, but they're never going to be huge businesses to justify millions of dollars of investment. You need to find a different path if you're going to do that. And so knowing, you can't just have a good idea. You have to, at the beginning, have a plausible argument as a founder if you're trying to raise millions of dollars that you can actually build a big business. And that's not an exercise that everybody goes through or really knows how to do. Similarly, if you've been outside of Silicon Valley, outside the mainstream, you may not understand what the kind of stages are. Mm-hmm. And so sort of to come in with just an idea and not experience or a track record, even if it's a great idea, but no team, no code, you're not going to go raise a multi-million dollar seed round. Mm-hmm. But there are accelerator programs of all over the country now, various kinds, and there are ones oriented to women, to first-time entrepreneurs, to entrepreneurs of color, and so on, that can actually help in those very, very formative stages before you actually try to go. And they often come with some funding, because founders we're talking about, you can't tell them, oh, well, go do your friends and family round, because their friends and family don't have, you know, money, right, to, you know, to put in. But there are an increasing number of, you know, of alternatives. And so I think one of piece of good news is there are so many more resources out there now that are low cost or entirely free for first time entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs of color. And there are communities and discussion groups and all sorts of things that you're not so alone anymore. It's a journey that you can and should take, you know, with other people. And that helps.
No, that's great advice. So four companies of the Upside Tech Alliance are prominently featured in the book. Can you describe the creation of this alliance and where it began and how far it's come?
Sure. So one of the things that we do for portfolio companies is every summer we gather a group of them on Martha's Vineyard for a kind of retreat. It gives them chances for the founders to hang out with each other, but we bring interesting people in to meet with. I mean, it's the sort of thing that VC firms do. One year, we were incredibly fortunate, really by more than a bit of luck, to have President Obama, former President Obama, come and meet with a group of 18 of folks for a private meeting for an hour and a half to just talk about, talked to each one about what they did. And I mean, it was an amazing event. Folks were so inspired that a group of them decided that they really wanted to work together more intently, because these were all companies that had solutions that addressed themselves to urgent social problems in cities, with job creation, air quality, things like that. And out of that common interest in how do we more effectively bring our solutions to the public sector, to cities and to states, that was the birth of the Upside Tech Alliance. And as a group, they have, and we provided some support, gone to the U.S. Conference of Mayors and other groups like that, and did pitches in a pitch competition and really developed that channel. Because for instance, let me give a company example. There's a company called Acclima. Mm-hmm. They do hyper-local air quality monitoring, which nobody else can do. They've got a little box that sits in the back of a Google mapping car that drives around the city or the equivalent. And they can, on a block-by-block basis, measure the air quality across the entire spectrum. And it turns out, in cities, you do not want to live downwind of a factory or an emitter. Well, mayors and their staffs can now target where these pollution hotspots are in cities and do something about it. But who lives downwind typically of this? It's low-income community. So this is a gap-closing kind of business. So how do you, and they now, Acclima is in California, New York. They have statewide initiatives. It's an example of a company in this Upside Tech Alliance that is really showing how private sector, you know, startups, tech startups can really, in a huge way, attack social problems and issues. So that's one of the several companies in this.
So do you sit on boards as people are coming in to KPOR Capital, or do you typically kind of roll up your sleeves? It sounds like you're having fun trying to think about some of these businesses too.
So I love entrepreneurs. I love working with them. It gives me the greatest professional joy and satisfaction in life. And so I am on some boards. But what's very important to note is that in the past couple of years, Frida and I have turned over the leadership of KPOR Capital to our younger partners, Brian Dixon and Ulili Onavakpuri. And we talk about them and their distance traveled stories in the book. They raised $126 million fund. That's KPOR Capital III, which they're the co-managing partners of. And they are leading the whole investment team now. Frida and I are anchor LPs in that fund, but we still have a large number of active investments made over the last decade, and that's where my board seats are. Mm-hmm. But Brian and Ulili, you know, it's one of the largest Black-led venture funds, and they are a full service firm. That they and the whole investment team, the other investors, the platform team, looking at thousands of new inquiries a year, making new investments, taking board seats, all that.
That's awesome. So you get to do
could not be prouder of them.
You get to do the fun stuff, right? You get to think about this. I saw you were at the EdTech conference down in San Diego, and and so what excites you about EdTech these days?
Well, one of the things that excites me is the use of generative AI by the gap closing EdTech companies to provide, there's a company called Numeraid that does really inexpensive, really high quality tutoring using generative AI examples with synthesized video and audio and Blackboard that just cover the entire spectrum of STEM classes, high school and college textbooks with the exercises and answers. And they'd been doing quite well for several years, but when they hooked up the generative AI, their coverage, their reach, just expanded of content, expanded dramatically. And, you know, for like $8 a month, all of this is open to you. You don't need to have a $300 an hour tutor, which you can't afford. And so using, AI to accelerate gap closing in ed tech is a super exciting area.
That's awesome. The name of that company again is
Numeraid, Numeraade.
Amazing. So I was going to ask you about AI. Not only everybody's talking about it these days, but what scares you about AI?
The pace of deployment of it as a technology is extraordinarily rapid, and government and regulation cannot keep pace with it. It's never been able to. It couldn't do it, with the internet, resulting in messes we still don't know how to clean up with, hate speech and disinformation and endless arguments about Section 230. and so here we are once again with AI facing that. Only the, adoption of ChatGPT went from 0 to 100 million people in, overnight, basically. And so, the unfolding consequences of we don't know what we're getting ourselves into are big. I was around and involved at the birth of the commercial internet in the 1990s. And I will tell you, back then, the people doing it were almost all just optimistic, mm-hmm. and we lived in our own bubble and were not thinking about all of the things that people would do with it. I mean, including all the bad things people are capable of. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lack of foresight there and, concerned, greatly concerned about a repetition of that, but, you know, with much higher stakes.
Well, closing the gap, or closing the equity gap, I should say, is an awesome, awesome book. Everybody needs to get their hands on this. But one last question while I have you here. So best advice that you've ever received?
I actually think that, again, I've been asked this in the past and I have a new answer.
Okay. I love it.
I think your personal relationships, whether in your personal life or in business, are precious and the most important resource. So try to do it on the basis of developing mutual trust. Mm-hmm. Don't be transactional. Don't be exploitative, but really come from your whole self, including your heart, and expect the same. And I think that is the path of greatest happiness and least regret and greatest fulfillment for yourself and for others.
A beautiful way to say that. Thank you so much, Mitch,
you're very welcome.
Coming on and for all the great insights and conversation. And we'll have all of the information that you talked about in the show notes, including closing the equity gap and K-Poor Capital and everything else. So thank you again. Have a great rest of the week, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to The Kara Golden Show. If you would, please give us a review and feel free to share this podcast with others who would benefit. And of course, feel free to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode of our podcast. Just a reminder that I can be found on all platforms at Kara Golden. And if you want to hear more about my journey, I hope you will have a listen or pick up a copy of my book, Undaunted, which I share my journey, including founding and building Hint. We are here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a great rest of the week and 2023. And goodbye for now. Before we sign off, I want to talk to you about fear. People like to talk about fearless leaders, but achieving big goals isn't about fearlessness. Successful leaders recognize their fears and decide to deal with them head on in order to move forward. This is where my new book, Undaunted, comes in. This book is designed for anyone who wants to succeed in the face of fear, overcome doubts, and live a little undaunted. Order your copy today at undauntedthebook.com and learn how to look your doubts and doubters in the eye and achieve your dreams. For a limited time, you'll also receive a free case of Hint Water. Do you have a question for me or want to nominate an innovator to spotlight? Send me a tweet at Kara Golden and let me know. And if you like what you heard, please leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow along with me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at Kara Golden. Thanks for listening.